You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I want people to listen to this and say, wow, this really helped me. And that, honestly, I love the fact that even when we met, you said, I really enjoy when people stop me. And they say, I've helped them, and I really inspired them. And that was what your mission was. And I remember when I was at Good Day New York, we had Ava DuVernay on, and one thing she said always really resonated with me, where she said, if your dreams aren't bigger than yourself, you're not dreaming big enough. And so I definitely see those things, and I try and remember them.
You do have like an extraordinary memory for, not for everything, but for like quotes and odd personal details. But the quotes though is weird.
Like, that's fine too. Like I've seen all kinds of people, and weird's fine. I am probably a little bit weird.
You are a little bit weird. Because you speak in quotes and you know every single human being on the planet.
No, of course. I just think you want to be genuine. You know, you want to be who you are.
Think about these quotes. They're all words of wisdom, kind of that have withstood the test of time in some form or other. And so kind of building a life philosophy around them is essentially a shortcut to having wisdom yourself. All right, ready?
I'm ready. Yeah, of course.
Ready, willing, and able. Steve Cohen, the producer of the world-famous podcast, The James Altucher Show. People are going to think I'm only having you on the podcast because we have no other guests, but obviously we have plenty of other guests. But I specifically asked you, and you, I don't even know if you wanted to come on. I specifically wanted you to come on this podcast to underline several things. Were you hesitant at first?
I was appreciative that you made the gesture because I think you're a great interview and you make everybody better. But I don't know. I wasn't hesitant. I guess I was because I think that I want our listeners to get the best out of this podcast. And so I think I was a little bit like, hey, and plus I've gotten all these other amazing guests on the show. So have a lot to live up to.
Yeah, you've got that. Well, that's the first thing I want to talk about. By the way, we're going to, I just want to explain the arc of this is going to be, this is a podcast about peak performance. I'm going to explain why you're the reasons why I think you're such a peak performer. But I'm just getting a little bit of background because you've been exposed to almost every branch of media there is.
Yeah.
And I think the specific skills you have, people could learn from. Now, first off, how many years were you in radio and how many years were you in TV?
Okay. I started at WCBS radio here in New York, and I went from local radio to network radio to ABC.
What'd you do for that?
I started out as a desk assistant and, just entry level, and you kind of worked overnights, and you would do, they had carts back then, and it was the number one or two all news radio station in the country, 1010 Winds and WCBS radio. And it was,
is that because it was in New York or because you worked for it? okay, wait. What did you rise up to? What was your final title?
I was managing editor over there. So you picked stories, and it was an afternoon drive show, and we did interviews every day.
So you picked stories for the number one radio show.
Yeah.
And was Howard Stern on the show then?
Howard Stern was on K-Rock. I mean, he was part of CBS Radio, but he wasn't. It was an all-news station. So our biggest competition was 1010 Winds, which famously said, like, oh, give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world. And so, by WCBS Radio, some of those people are still there.
Then what happened? I have to interrupt you a lot.
Yeah, of course, obviously. And, then I went to ABC Radio. Somebody who had worked at WCBS Radio had offered me a position over there, and it was a bigger title.
And I remember when we were on when I was on Dan Harris's podcast over at ABC, you're walking through ABC and everyone's like, Steve,
this is
the best. They were telling me, this is the best person I ever worked with. Like, we couldn't walk 5 feet without someone else stopping you at ABC.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was almost like James Apalooza in Dallas. You were getting mobbed.
It was Steve Apalooza, ABC. So what was your highest title at ABC?
I had a title called Manager of News Planning. It was a network radio station, and I was there around the millennium. And so, like, I kind of was in charge of millennium's, just stories about the millennium. Remember the Y2K problem? Or in 2000, there was an Olympics. There was presidential race. And so a lot, and it was a national newsroom. I also was there on 9/11, and I remember, when that happened, when those planes...
Were you at work at when the planes hit?
Yeah, I remember it obviously distinctly.
How did you jump into action and cover the story?
Well, in 9/11, I was one of the managers there, and it was at 8 or something in the morning. And I remember I was in my office, among other reasons, because at the time I was considering moving to TV, and I had an interview at Good Morning America on that day at September 11th. And so I was watching Good Morning America. And I remember Charlie Gibson and Diane, I was watching Diane Sawyer and them. But then you saw news locally, like a plane hit the World Trade Center.
So did you jump up and start calling reporters?
I jumped up, and I wasn't honestly sure. Like, when you're at national radio, and obviously there were other managers and everybody started stirring, I wasn't that high up on the totem pole, but I was one of the managers. And I remember... You kind of like everybody else. You're kind of like, okay, if there's a fire at the World Trade Center, is it a national story? Do you break into the thousands of affiliates across the country? At the time, it was hard for me to kind of realize that. But one thing I did follow back on in February, I had been sent to this conference on terrorism, and the Chicago Tribune did it, the McCormick Foundation. And I remember it was one of those things where you would go and there was 50 to 60 people in media there, and a lot of those people you eventually saw on TV were all there. And I was, correspondents or ambassadors. I remember there was a guy, Jerry Hauer, Jerry Hauer was in charge of the mayor's emergency management thing. Then he went on to work for Kroll. And I remember we got our anchors in there, and once everything started materializing, we were on the air, obviously, for a week straight, with just updates and all kind of correspondence. But I do remember, calling Jerry Hauer because...
See, by the way, and this is this is the beginnings of how you developed your superpower, which I'll get to in a little bit. But here's an event that you went to 6 months earlier than 9/11. Yeah. You probably had every single person at that conference in your contacts list. You immediately called, you know, someone, and he was like probably happy to hear from you in this, given this event and everything. And you started working on a plan.
Yeah. Well, he bought us a lot of time because he had a lot of credibility, and it was Jerry Hauer. And I remember very distinctly, he felt like this was a totally new thing. And because
new thing in terms of terrorism?
Totally new thing in terrorism. And I remember at one of those conferences, and I'm sure people go to a lot of them, and you're kind of not paying attention, and you're kind of like, oh yeah, this is going to happen. Like, and they were talking about, like, I remember NBC, like, you know, different kinds of chemical weapons, and I forget what the acronym, you know, biological, chemical, or, you know, and nuclear terrorism. And Jerry was one of the lecturers there, and I kind of knew him from Mayor Giuliani's office, and I imagine I was one of the first people who called him because it was before 9 o'clock. I mean, it was right when it happened. And he told our anchors in our live breaking coverage, he said, you know, this is different, this kind of thing, because before terrorists would get in a plane and they would probably, they would look to hold it hostage. And he said, guys, if somebody wants to take a plane and crash it, what could you do? You know, once they have
the plane. And so before 9 a.m. on that day, even... nobody was totally sure it was terrorism. Yeah. I don't think people were really sure it was terrorism until the Pentagon got hit, which was more around like 9:15 or 9:30.
He was the first person I called, and I remember it was really early, and I could be off on the time, but it was definitely right when right around when those planes hit, and you knew that something was wrong. And I just suspected that he was a guy.
So
who
did
was
you break into, you make the decision we,
yeah,
to break
we, oh,
into?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And by that
all
point.
The affiliates.
Yeah, we were like, now we're going into live breaking coverage, and then people were down by 9/11 and by the ground zero, and then it began, you know, weeks of coverage, you know, with everything.
Okay, so then after that, what was your next
show? After that, a couple of months later, I was considering going to Good Morning America or CBS Early Show, and
why'd you want to get into TV?
I just felt like I was ready to do something else.
What made you feel ready?
I felt like the gum was losing its flavor. I'd been doing it for a while, and I felt like I was ready to do something. I think I was ready to kind of progress into that. And I think in everybody's career is different. In college, I was one of the editors of the school paper, and I went from like print to, and then I liked radio. I liked the immediacy of radio. And I kept getting bigger positions, but I think I was ready to try something different, and TV excited me.
So you were always interested in journalism in some form or other. Yeah, at University of Michigan, you were one of the editors of the school paper. Yeah. You got into radio, then you went into TV.
Yes.
And so what was your, by the way, I don't know if I ever told you this, in the late 1950s, my dad was one of the editors of the University of Michigan paper. So, and at the same time as
Tom Hayden,
no, there was a novelist. I forgot her name, Margaret something.
Oh wow, Spellman?
No.
Okay,
I forget.
I'm gonna stop guessing. Yeah.
So then the TV.
I came over to the CBS Early Show, and we were still doing 9/11 stories. And
how does someone know when they're ready to not necessarily make a lateral shift in career, but a kind of vertical shift? You know, you were feeling like, okay, I've done this radio for a long time, and I'm ready to kind of take a jump in company and a jump in kind of medium.
Yeah, well, I had looked at Good Morning America, and at the time they were making me an offer too, as was the early. I think once, like, I didn't have an interview that day, then I remember that my dad had a patient. My dad is a physician. He had a patient who was an editor there, and he said, why doesn't he talk to the Early Show, you know, if he's interested in Good Morning America? And then I'd started my career at CBS Radio, and I kind of liked the culture a little bit different than ABC TV.
Why is that?
I felt like when you'd go around CBS, and they kind of had that reputation with kind of a venerable show like 60 Minutes, and it had been around for a long time, and ABC seemed more glamorous, and the offices were even nicer, and, you know, CBS, those people, you know, just kind of rolled up their sleeves, and that was my perception of it. Like, Dan Rather, Andy Rooney, and
Walter Cronkite. Wasn't he not at that time, but
no, he had left in 1981, and Dan Rather came. So yeah, and so I felt like that's where I started, and I also felt like when I would see the people at ABC, and I interacted with a lot of them because at radio, like I'd have to go over to meetings with the national. It was something called News One, which is still around, or TV or .com, and you'd go deal with all these different people. So I'd see them, or you'd have correspondence from 2020 or Good Morning America, where you'd be on conference calls. So you were there at the culture.
And in CBS?
At ABC.
At ABC. So who was in charge of .com then at ABC?
ABCnews.com was a guy named Bernie Gershon. Very talented guy, you know, and just really smart and ahead of the curve with things.
And what's he doing right now?
He is a consultant, you know, Bernie. You know, for who? He left. He kind of is doing his own thing. He's doing some very cool things.
By the way, the reason I ask, yeah. I don't actually care what he's doing. The reason I ask is that this was 18 years ago, yeah. And we're going to get to your super mutant power slope bit by bit. This is 18 years ago. You probably could call him right now, and he'd pick up the phone and say, "Hey, Steve Cohen."
Yeah, yeah.
And you know some of. I picked a random thing out of all the departments you just mentioned. I said, "Who was it? And what's he doing now?" I don't remember from the year 2000 what anybody who anybody was that I was working with and what they're doing now, except for maybe like one person who I'm still working with.
I try joke sometimes like that I'm a diamond. I'm forever. Like I try and be very. I try and just. If I'm with you, I'm with you, you know, and I appreciate people.
But it's hard to keep that up with 100,000 people, which is what I suspect is your actual the size of your network.
Yeah, I definitely have a lot of people in my Rolodex or phone. I definitely do, you know. I just try to be very genuine. I'm not great on social media, like, which is probably a fault of mine.
And yet people think social media is networking. But I've seen real networking in how you operate, and we'll get to that in a second. Let's just, so now.
But I guess my point with that was I always was very skeptical of a lot of that, even the phrase network or, you know, even, I always felt like.
It's a little fake.
I felt it was fake, and I just felt like I never want to handle people. For those who are listening, I have my quote bunnies up, like Richard Nixon, I'm not a crook. But I think that I remember Madonna once said, like, she said, insecure people reinvent themselves and secure people evolve, which isn't meant to be a diss, but to the author of Reinvent Yourself. But I also...
I was an insecure person.
But I also feel like, and maybe it's semantics, but I felt like insecure people network and secure people offer their friendship. They want to work with you and they want to make things a win-win and like, hey, how can we all do stuff together? Like jazz musicians play music or pick up basketball just kind of like, hey, let's work together. Let's really make things interesting and let's create something. And so I've always kind of had that instinctive ability to do that. And I always just tried to, I remember Harvey McKay wrote a book called Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty. And I just always tried to just, you know, do my homework every day and then compile a list. And news is always about contacts and associations. It's about, oh, this thing is happening in terrorism. Who can we associate with it? And who's our contact? And how can you get to them quickly? And, you know, when I was in radio and I started, and obviously, I guess, like, looking back, I spent a long time doing it. And we talk a lot about the 10,000 hours. And people at radio used to say, like, oh, what's the world's largest microphone, a telephone? You know, like, you can call anybody. And I always felt like, I was definitely very competitive. And I felt like, of course I'm going to get that person. And
When there's nothing happening, do you have ways of keeping the network intact?
Yeah.
So like, if you see someone in the news, you send a note and say, congratulations, you did this.
Yeah, because I think that one of my bigger influences was the basketball coach, John Wooden, and he always felt like the slightest good deed was the slightest good deed is better than the greatest of intentions. And so I want to be happy for other people and I want to do things just for the sake of doing them. I don't really have an agenda and it's, I noticed that you started your own company. Congratulations. Or, hey, I saw this. There are times where I think, you know, almost like Mother Teresa says, like, do it anyway, where somebody gets a job. Like, I always remember, like, Matt Lauer, when he famously told that story, you know, when he got the job, he was working at Nine Broadcast Plaza, Channel 9, a local thing. And 1 year he got 6 Christmas cards. And the next year he got 200, you know. But if I feel like I'm good intentioned, I'm not going to let the potential stigma of like reaching out to somebody just when they're successful, you know.
You say because Matt Lauer got successful in one year. So he went from 6 to 200 Christmas cards.
Yeah, because
it's sort of like Walter Mondale, who used to be Vice President of the United States. He said, I always... used to think I had a great sense of humor, and then and then after I was no longer Vice President of the United States, no one will laugh at my jokes anymore.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I try to maintain friendships, and I'm careful about, more so now, you know, about like who you keep around. And
it's always very sincere, because I see you I see you talking to all these people. You know the details of their lives. You ask about them, ask about their families. You travel to their parents' funerals. Like you really keep up with everybody. And I'll just give a quick example. Like one time, this is when Curb Your Enthusiasm was coming out. And I said, you know who I'd really want to get on the show? And we ended up not getting him on the show for various reasons.
Well, I spoke to them yesterday. They said they want to do it. So hopefully. Yeah.
But I said, I really wanted J.B. Smoove. You like out of memory, like you'd like dial his phone number and you say, here. And I'm talking to J.B. Smoove on the phone. It's like my favorite, you know, comedian on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And then I met him the next day. He's hung out with me and my daughter. But then he had to go back to L.A. or whatever.
Yeah. And I think what I always try and say to us, it's kind of like, you know, and for the listeners out there in the proverbial James Altucher cubicle or whatever, your bedroom or you're on your path, I think that we'll get hopefully into why I'm here. But I think like I want us to have the best podcast around. I think you're an amazing interviewer. You're terrific. And we'll get back to why I want to be here. But what I'm saying, it's like I want us to have people that when people talk about like when you write something, you don't want it just read. You want it spread. You want people to like look at it. And I heard Seth Godin speak about how, you know, something remarkable is just that. It's remarkable. There's a difference between excellent and remarkable. You're like not just like, wow, that's good. You're like, you remark to somebody like, wow, did you see this? And I want us to do that. And I mean, that's why I'm overjoyed to be here. And for those wondering, this isn't like Pravda or, you know, like what's the Russian?
That is the Russian newspaper.
Meaning like, I'm not like, I'm saying this genuinely on my own free will and volition.
What Seth Godin said is really interesting, because I think that is the success. People always ask the question, how can I market my book better? How can I market my podcast better? And at that point, it's almost too late once they're asking that.
Yeah.
Because the way it has to be embedded in the product itself, that this is not just a good product, it's something that people are going to want to remark on. Like you can have something that's extraordinary, but if nobody wants to share it with their friends, it's not going to spread. Yeah. But even before you came on board, I started doing everything, in person, because I realized any one of my listeners were willing to listen to something, one of my podcasts, even if it wasn't in person. But when it was in person, there was a much higher likelihood that people would then share it, because not only the podcast was better because there's all the kind of nonverbal communication, but just the audio quality was simply better. Yeah. So they're not embarrassed about sharing it to their friends. Often with Skype, the audio quality is not so good.
Well, I think the details separate the good from the great. It's like when we had Wolfgang Puck here, he talked about we have the best ingredients, we have the best food, and we don't, you know, and so we care. And
we're going to get to your various mutant powers, but you've quoted people at least 8 times in the first 5 minutes. And you quoted John Wooden, Madonna, quoted Wolfgang Puck, Seth Godin. Who else did you quote? Matt Lauer, that's 5 people.
I'm sure I'll have a lot more. John Wooden. Yeah, I definitely quoted John Wooden. He was somebody who I think about often, because in fact, you know, when I look back at what I was doing, one of the things I probably always say to myself is things work out best for those who make the best of the way things work out.
John Wooden.
I just, because I look at
Things
work out best for those who make the best of the way things work out. And it helps me. Like it helps me look at things and say, okay, you know.
What's an example of that? It's a hard one. It's a little bit of a tongue twister.
It means how, okay, you know, it's kind of like our Jocko Willink, who says, like, no matter what happens to him, he says, good. I broke my leg. Good. I could use the other leg.
So, like, it's sort of like, you know, play the cards you're dealt.
Yeah, yes. It means, like, you play the, yes, it definitely means you play the cards you're dealt. And, but it's also, yeah. I couldn't say about any better than that.
All right. So, wait. Let's just, because I want to, you've basically been in media for 30 years. So, and now you're a podcast producer.
Yeah, I'm excited.
The peak of your career is producing
zenith,
a podcast.
Zenith.
So, okay. You went to TV. How long were you?
I was in TV. And I worked at TV. Like, I was a desk assistant. Like, when I was at WCBS Radio, I looked at it like graduate school for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like...
What did you majored in journalism,
I majored...
Right?
Yeah, I was an English major, and I was pre-med because my dad was a doctor, but that wasn't for me, you know, as much as I tried. And
You cannot do biology labs or chemistry labs.
No, and you know, it's just funny. I remember freshman year in college, I had a lab partner from Hong Kong, and brilliant guy. His name was Wyatt Toh. And he said, Steve, I picked you because of your Jewish heritage, and I thought you'd be a lot smarter. But you
would not be able to.
No,
you
have a and kind I'm glad. Of, I'm glad. Yeah, it's like, hey,
it's not one of your mutant powers.
No, 100%. No,
cut up frogs and
no, 1,000%
follow orders
no,
like that.
Again, like I like to say, there's no right way to do the wrong thing, and so
who's that quoting?
I saw that. And a documentary about the Bloods and the Crips, and it was at LA County Jail, and it always stuck with me because it said up on the jail, it said, there's no right way to do the wrong thing. And I felt like, that's right. You know, it's a good message for these rehabilitating
prisoners. What are some examples of that in real life that you've seen?
I think you've talked about in business where it's, if you're with the wrong people or you're with the wrong kind of I mean, there's a lot of it, obviously. Oh, I'm just going to take this thing for 1 minute and bring it back. Or, I'm just going to... We've had this before where people say, if you want to do this interview, we're going to make sure, you know, you can't ask about this, or could you give us the questions? And that's an example of maybe nobody notices it, but it's the wrong thing and it's not right. And it just sets a downward slope. And
right. We've never done any interview like
and
that.
I remember when I started, I felt like, okay, James is into finance and everything. And I thought the Wolf of Wall Street was going to be interesting, Jordan Belfort. And they were very insistent on, well, what are the questions or what are you going to ask? And then I was kind of like, we don't give the questions. It's not something we do, you know?
Right.
It's like, here's what you wrote a book and we're going to ask you about stuff. And if you don't want to answer it, don't answer it, but we're going to ask you it. And I remember there was just so much kind of pushback and they were trying to micromanage it. And we wound up scrambling and putting Mike Posner, who you wound up doing an amazing interview with. And Mike Posner was so impressed with you. And he said, wow, you really deep dove. You were really into this. And you said, Steve was going to have, Wolf of Wall Street, and I said, he's a criminal. I don't want him on. So I was impressed both with your candor and just that, yeah, you prepared, you know, and so I definitely appreciate that.
So then how long were you at TV?
Okay, I was at TV for 15 years, really, because I was at the CBS Early Show for 10, and then I was at Good Day New York for 5. But I did want to get back, when you mentioned J.B. Smoove, the purpose of all of this is our listeners. I want people. I want us to have the best possible show. I want you to be the best you possibly can. And I'm hoping we're going to talk about that fateful day, 2 days where we met and we said, hey, we're going to partner. We're going to really do amazing things here because I want our people. That, you know, in the words of James Taylor, that's why I'm here. Like, I want us to be.
Why did James
amazing.
Taylor say that?
I don't know. You wrote that album, right? That's why I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I've seen fire. I've seen rain. And
okay. So you, Do you realize, like, you remember every quote from every movie? Like, you remember some obscure documentary about the Bloods and the Crips. You remember what was, like, somebody, while they were on their way to the death execution room, he had, like, tapped into the wall. Like, there's no right way to do the wrong thing. And you remembered that.
Yeah.
And James Taylor, Matt Lauer.
Yeah.
If I give you, like, a random person, could you, like oh. I'll give a quote from... George W. Bush. Oh, you quoted Richard Nixon earlier, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember one time I was at a party and a friend, his friend Steve Herz, who's a prominent agent, and he was introducing me to people, and he's like, wow, Steve Cohen's like Rain Man. And, you know, and he introduced me to a broadcaster, and I said, oh, yeah, born in 1968, University of Maryland, and like, you're creepy and everything. I was like, no, I just remember things, you know?
Have like an extraordinary memory for... Not for everything, but for like quotes and like odd personal details.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny because...
But the quotes, though, is weird. Like, you remember... Yes. Like, okay, I'm going to name like... what's an obscure movie? Jay, what's an obscure movie that you've seen? Okay, Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee.
Oh, wow.
Well, give me a quote from Enter the Dragon.
That one I remember, like, I remember from like the 70s. I could tell you stuff from The Last Dragon... with Shown Up and Bruce Leroy. Remember that movie?
No.
With Timac, where it was about martial artist from Harlem, and his name was Leroy, and they called him Bruce Leroy, and it was a Berry Gordy film. For those of you out there.
So it was kind of a spoof on Enter the Dragon?
It was a terrific movie. It was like Vanity was in it. It was a great movie.
Bruce
Lee
had some good quotes, though, in Enter the Dragon. I encourage you to...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. No, I mean, like... When I think of Bruce Lee, I think of, I fear the person who does one kick 1,000 times rather than 1,000 kicks one time.
Yeah.
But, if I've seen it, yes. I remember years ago a friend of mine and I feel like men quote movies more than women. I guess that is how my mind works. Like, and I remember... One time I was with another friend of mine and we were in the Hamptons and we were these women and they were like, all you guys do is quote movies.
Yeah, but I think you do it more than anyone else I've ever seen. Do you know anyone who knows as many quotes as you?
Well, it's like, they say in Dodgeball, if you could dodge a wrench, you could dodge a ball.
Wait, who said, from the movie Dodgeball?
Yes. When,
who said that?
Rip Torn. No, Rip Torn kept like, he was this weird, like Hank Azaria played the young Patches O'Houlihan and he had like, it was like a spoof on sports movies and like he had them
Isn't Vince Vaughn and Ben Stiller?
Vince Vaughn and Ben Stiller were in it, but like it was just like he needed money for his gym to do things and so he had like Hank Azaria played like this guy who was an expert at dodgeball and then Rip Torn played him as an older person and he was teaching him how to play dodgeball and he was giving them all these drills about dodgeball and he like takes a wrench and wings it at them and he was saying if you can dodge a wrench, you could dodge a ball, which I always felt like means like if you could do something really difficult, you could do something easy.
So A, that's an interesting quote
to
learn from. B, I've seen dodgeball maybe 3 or 4 times. I do not even remember the scene. I don't remember those actors. That's why I don't remember these things I don't know if it's because I'm a normal human being or because I have early onset Alzheimer's or you just remember all these details.
But
you don't remember everything. You remember quotes.
Yeah, exactly.
You speak in quotes.
Yes. Well, it's funny because sometimes I just think it's funny and like
These things that you learn from, like the wrench and the ball. That's you. It's not only you remember the quotes, it's like you have the quote is the tip of the iceberg, and then you think about it's like you spend time thinking about the quote afterwards.
But I remember, I don't want to jump around here, of course. Those of you in your cubicle probably have a hard time following, but I think that, I try and learn from everything that I'm doing, but I think. I remember, and you were very gracious, and when we talked, I'd like for people to know, like, that you see or hear, that's who you are, and that's one of the reasons that drawn me to you, but you were like, Steve, I'm looking for somebody, and we discussed partnering or coming in, and I said, hey, like Shimon Peres said to Yasser Arafat, if you have a plan, it works once, if you have a partner, it works a lifetime, and it is how... I try not to be like a self-parody. Like, that is how I talk. And I remember when we started back in September, I was in you know, we had booked a guest, like one of our first guests, and you called me and said, Steve, I'm so sorry. I feel really bad. Oh my God, it won't happen again. But I need to do something else and I couldn't do it. I'm like, it's okay. Good news is never late. And never let a temporary inconvenience get in the way of permanent improvement. It's fine. And that is how I think. That is probably how I see the world. And which obviously, if you see it through the lens or prism of like a Hallmark card and everything is epigrammatic saying, it's not the best thing in the world.
No, not necessarily, because you take these, think about these quotes.
Yeah.
They're all words of wisdom, kind of that have withstood the test of time in some form or other. And so kind of building a life philosophy around them is essentially a shortcut to having wisdom yourself.
Well, but I also remember, like, I remember we had gone to see a movie and you were gracious enough to introduce me and said, Steve really thinks that we can get so-and-so on the podcast or whatever. And I was kind of, I said, well, listen, if I'm going after Moby Dick, I bring tartar sauce. Like, I always expect to get the best and to do it. And some of it's like bravado for humor's sake, but I think also, why not, right? Yeah. Like, why not, you know, or like I'll joke and say, take a chance. Columbus took a chance. You know, like there's ways to think about things. And I think that, you know, I do. And if I hear something that sounds, that resonates with me, I kind of chew on it. Like the same way I remember James Carville, I heard him speak about politics. And he said, like, all leaders deal with hope, right? Like Confucius years ago felt like it's hope. Like, and you should inspire people for their better angels. And so for us, what we're doing here, I want people to listen to this and say, wow, this really helped me. And that, honestly, it's, you know, and we'll get back to what really motivated me to want to work with you and to come here. But I love the fact that you said, and even when we met, and, you know, I guess we're jumping around, but the one thing that I really liked was you said, I really enjoy when people stop me and they say, I've helped them and I really inspired them. And that was what your mission was. And I think, you know, I remember when I was at Good Day New York, we had Ava DuVernay on, and one thing she said always really resonated with me, where she said, if your dreams aren't bigger than yourself, you're not dreaming big enough, you know? So that's, why are we here? Like, we want to make things better, you know? In your books, you said, who would I help today, you know? Or, and so I definitely see those things, and I try and remember them, because I think my mind is all over the place, and I think a lot of times you have to go back to fundamentals and say, okay, this is what I have to do. Like every day I have to read the papers, or I don't know if I'd said this, you know, like when I was in TV or radio, I always felt like there's no such thing as a slow news day, only lazy reporters. I felt like, you know, let's go. Like, and you know, or you have to make what's important interesting. And if you're going to do it, let's be the best.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, Of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
So you're at all these early shows, yeah. and you know, Good Day New York, yeah. and this is not a criticism of any one show, yeah. But like morning TV in general, there's a certain characteristics of it as opposed to let's say, so morning TV is mostly news, and then there's like afternoon news, kind of like your 5 o'clock news, sure. And then there's kind of late night shows, which are not really news, but are kind of comedic news, yeah. like the Daily Show. And I feel morning news is the lightest because, you know, people are just getting ready for work. It's supposed to be a little lighthearted. There's like a cooking segment.
Sure.
You know, it's a little more self-helpish.
Sure.
And then the segments are more, here's interesting things are happening as opposed to like, you know, President Trump said yesterday. Yeah. And so it seems like, but those segments are so light. Like, yeah. if a book author wants to talk about his book, he has 3 to 5 minutes to do it with commercials and with, you know, the host, obviously, he can't read all the books, so he hasn't read the book, so he's just asking kind of questions on an index card that an assistant handed him a few seconds earlier. So you can't really get depth.
Sure.
In general, I'm not criticizing any one show on. It's just the whole segment of shows.
Look, I think like the way TV worked from 7 to 9 and, you know, top of the 7, you would like have the breaking news. And I guess what helped me was I was somebody who definitely had to produce a lot. I had a lot of different jobs in TV, but
yeah, your last thing was and me for you did this for a long time. You were producing these shows, so you would have to get the guests and bring them on.
Yeah.
And every time I was stopped by Good Day New York, the green room was filled with like these amazing guests. Like the Olympics had just happened. We met the 2016 Olympics had just happened.
Yeah,
and
well, I should tell people. You know, not to interrupt, but you're the expert interrupting.
Go right ahead.
No, but like James was in the front page of the New York Times, and there was a really great article about your minimalism, and the people there saw it, and the anchors saw it, and they were like, hey, we need to get this guy. And so I'd reached out, and, you know, and thankfully you had come on, and I knew you had known Brian Koppelman, and then you came, and... Yeah, I felt like I definitely made sure, like every day it was an opportunity. I looked at TV not as a privilege, not as a reward, but as a responsibility and a privilege. And I felt like we have a, you know, I never was pretentious about journalism, but I said like, hey, let's do our best. Like, this is our time to do it and let's go. And so, yeah, and when you came, I was incredibly impressed. Like, you was like had a lot of mystique, you know, and yeah, I knew you had a daughter and I said, hey, I always like to tell guests who else was on the show and to just try and make connections and make it stickier and to think like, okay, I want them to have an experience, you know, where they get the most out of it when they're there. And I noticed that a lot. Like, I would have a lot of cool people in there and they'd always remember it, you know. I think most notably, I remember when we had Brian Grazer on, who wrote a book called The Curious Mind, and he was really interested in a lot of stuff. And he was unbelievable because I realized, like, as I did with you, that he was pretty authentic. Like, we had Michael Buffer, the Let's Get Ready to Rumble guy. We had...
Well, you were constantly... You had great guests, and you were constantly pulling them in. So I think that your years in TV, getting thousands of guests for these shows, hooked you up with not only all the guests, but all their managers, agents, publicists. So that built... this extraordinary network for you. Like, and then I don't know how you keep up with all the publicists, agents, managers, people, but you do.
I was always very receptive to them. Like, I felt like, I remember years ago I read a book by Herb Cohen or heard him talk about negotiating. And
he said, Southwest Airlines guy?
No, that's Herb Kelleher. Herb Cohen was Rich Cohen's dad, who you had the Rolling Stones book, Rich Jude, and all that. Yeah. And he was very interesting. And I remember like, listening about what he was saying. And he was saying sometimes in a negotiation, a guy goes in there and he's trying to buy a car and maybe he wants to get it down $1,000. Maybe he just wants to be treated with respect. Maybe he wants to impress his girlfriend. Maybe, you know, and I just think like, to me, maybe that publicist wants to just have somebody respond to them. And I had hundreds, if not thousands of them said, wow, you were always so nice. And I just feel like it's a marathon, not a sprint. You know, you're trying to play the long game and you're trying to have partners with these people. And if you know, if you're not, and be honest with them and to say, okay, this one doesn't work, but here's why.
Well,
I dig my well before I'm thirsty. I would say, I would know. So a month or two later, I would know. And I think a funny story is one time when I was at the early show, I was outside and I met Suge Knight was there and everybody was intimidated to go up to him. And I walked right up to him and I said, hi, I'm Steve Cohen. You know, I'm at CBS Early Show and perhaps we could have you on someday. And they're like, why would you go up to him? And I was joking, but I was like, he could smoke somebody or next week or 2 weeks and we might need him and you never know. And at least I have his information. And lo and behold, he got into some trouble and I remember it was Suge at the Row, you know, but I felt like.
Were you able to get him on?
Oh yeah. Well, he called in or like we dealt with him. Yeah. I think like, I always felt like, if you don't ask, I remember a guy I always was impressed with, and I think we should have him on, is Pat Croce, who, like, I remember reading an article on him in Success Magazine, and he said, if you don't ask, the answer is always no. And he talked about how he went from being the trainer of the Philadelphia 76ers then to owning 40 fitness centers and just how he really built himself up. I was inspired by that.
I agree with that. But you can't, but then asking itself is a subtle skill. So like when you're going up to Suge Knight and just being friendly and saying, hey, and just exchanging information, that's subtle. If you said, hey, can you come on? I know you're a busy guy. Can you come on tomorrow? Good Day New York, that might be too much. Oftentimes people ask me because they think it can't hurt. They said, hey, I'm in town for a day. Can you have coffee with me tomorrow? Yeah. It'll only be 5 minutes. It's never 5 minutes. It's an hour. And, you know, and then it's up to me. He just outsourced a no to me. Like, I have to now say no or I'm rude because I didn't respond. And that happens to me a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's how you ask, too. Like, okay. what's the best way to ask?
The best way to ask somebody is to being mindful of what they want and to make it clear to them that it could benefit them, you know, and it's not.
So Adam Grant has this distinction between givers, takers, and I guess the people in the middle are like transactioners. Right. I forget what he called it.
Did you ever hear that joke? I remember somebody said to me, Steve, I view the world as being divided into givers and takers. And I said, I view the world as being divided into people who divide the world into categories, people who don't divide the world into categories.
I have heard that joke.
Okay, at least I try. Like, for the listeners out there, I always felt like, even if they're not the best jokes, I think at least you're trying to be good-natured.
But
Adam Grant, sorry.
I think what you're saying is, before you go up to someone, you don't know if they're a giver or a taker or if they're transactional in some way.
Yeah.
And so you kind of play it from all angles. Like, you make sure you're delivering before you ask them.
Yeah.
So you're like polite to them, but maybe you might comment on something they did, you know, that's newsworthy and that you admired. And then you might say, you know, maybe one day, or you're never really pushy about it.
No. And I felt like one of the things I always felt like, it's how do you get people to a party? You invite them early, you invite them often, you be a good host, you tell them who else is at the party, you give them party favors, you know, you make them feel good about doing it, and you're honest and you're authentic. And some of the people that we've had here or whoever that I wasn't crazy about, I didn't find them genuine. I didn't find them authentic. And, you know, getting back to you, like, I meant to say with Brian Grazer, but Brian Grazer was like so excited to talk to Michael Buffer because he does that thing where every 2 weeks he talks to somebody and he was like, great, I don't have to do it anymore. Like, he was there and I thought it was really cool. And like, just that, I thought like, that's who he is. He wasn't trying to sell a book. He really did it for its own sake. And so, and when I saw you, you know, we talked like that day you were there and then you would come when Ryan Holiday was there. You were so interested in everybody else there, but you were unassuming. You didn't have a sense of entitlement. You were nice to everybody around there. And I found even to people who I felt should have known who you were but didn't, like, you know, I felt like, yeah, I thought that was terrific. I thought that was really great.
When I came on the first time, it was after that New York Times piece you mentioned. I don't actually remember very well my segment.
Yeah.
But I do remember because you had mentioned... Yeah. This was right after the Olympics. Lori Hernandez, who I guess won silver gold in gymnastics, was on, and my daughter was a big fan. And I guess you had read I had a daughter, and you said have your daughter come in, and then the thing I remember is my daughter, me, and Lori Hernandez took a photo together.
Sure.
So that was good. That's the thing I remember the most from first appearance.
And I think I'm the son of a physician, and my parents are people around me, and my dad always had a bedside manner. I see him now, 50 years he's been doing it, and he knows all these patients. He sat down with them, and he cared about them. He was a caregiver. He cared about people, and that's the currency that you have over there with them. And I always tried to do that with the people I worked with, or, you know, I try to be thoughtful. Like, if there was, you know, and I've always felt that those that know you best should love you most, like those people around you. And so I'd like to think that if you stopped in the street and saw somebody who worked with me, they would say, wow, he was thoughtful, or he was a nice person, or if there were guests on the show, if there was somebody who liked Ultimate Fighting, I would say, oh, you know, Tyler loves Ultimate Fighting, you should meet, you know, Ronda Rousey. Or I tried to be thoughtful. Or if like David Ortiz was there, and like the guy from the mailroom, I remember he was speaking Spanish with him, and I said, oh, he taught himself Spanish just so he could meet you, or, you know, and I tried to be thoughtful. And I do think the little things add up, and, you know, like with people. But
But here's the question I have. So I'm really bad at following up with people.
Yeah.
Like, I'll meet them and then they'll write me emails, and I focus very much on, you know, I try to write, I try to prepare for podcasts, I podcast, I do, you know, stand-up comedy. But a lot of people will meet me and then write emails like, hey, it was nice to meet you. Or I'll meet people who are guests on this podcast. Yeah. And I feel like I want to follow up and I want to build a network and I want to connect. I just don't have the time or the energy, and it's not on the top list of my priorities. Although for you, building your network for 30 yeah. years has been on the top of your priorities. But like when you had 500 people in your network and you're keeping yeah. track of all of them yeah. and following up, that's one thing. I think now you have at least, just from what I've seen, you have at least 10,000 people in your network. Like it must be half the day just following up with all of them.
Yeah, no, I think also like the perfect's enemy of the good. And sometimes it's like, and sometimes you, if you don't do it right away, you know, like the other day we did a great podcast with Mike Massimino, and thank you, Mike, for coming. And thank you, Kathy, you know, his manager, who was great. And I feel like sometimes you put pressure on yourself to be like, wow, I have to write this really florid email, or I want to, and then the longer you wait, the more burdensome it is. But if you yeah. do it right away, then it's, you don't have that psychic energy of feeling guilty. And, you know, I think we all learn from people around us. And I had a friend who was at William Morris Agency, and they famously always get back to somebody within a day. And I tried to just get better at that. One stitch in time saves nine. Like if you could do it in that sense. But I also feel like what I've told you, remember, with people around you, like those that matter don't mind and those that mind don't matter. Like those people who genuinely want what's best for you, they just want to hear from you. They want to see you. Like, and so there have been, when we went to trips and I had friends in those places, and then before I used to think like, wow, you know, I don't want to email them at the last minute. But like the people who really want to see you, you can email them anytime, call them, or and you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be honest. I just try and be honest. Like, hey, I'm sorry it didn't work out. I did the best I possibly could. You know, I'll make it up to you. You know, and I think that that's really, it's just, I just try and be as honest as possible. We've had guests who weren't happy, but like, I also saw the world.
Wait, we had guests who were unhappy?
No, not us. Here, no. We didn't have any, honestly, and I'm not just saying it, like, we didn't have any guests who were unhappy. But I'm like, at Good Day New York, one of the anchors might have said something, or the early show, they want, you know, we asked tough questions, and, you know, I remember one time, I'll give you a fun story. Like, so one year we interviewed Bill Clinton for the Clinton Global Initiative. And one of the anchors, I went with Harry Smith, who's a terrific anchor. And one time we didn't get to really ask him about the Clinton Global Initiative. It was like, I want to say it was 2008, the country, you know, and a lot of stuff was going on. And it was like the meltdown, and Obama was there. It was like October, I forget, maybe September, October 2008. And there was all this stuff going on. And so Harry Smith said, you know, hey, sorry, President Clinton, you know, I'm gonna have to take a rain check on that whole situation. And they went ballistic. I mean, like his people were like, rain check, you know, and like, and for a long time they were disappointed, and they kept emailing, like if somebody at Face the Nation had wanted to ask something, they would say, sorry, we'll have to take a rain check on that request. And so then I remember like with these early show umbrellas, and I sent like 10 of them saying, hey, you know, I sent them like, those people, like Clinton's people, umbrellas saying, hey, I just thought you might want these umbrellas in case it rains. And eventually it thawed things out. But, you know, I could play the music. I can't always make everybody dance. You
but
know?
Still, it's like, it seems like you're always thinking of that extra effort to keep in touch. Like, I think half the reason you read the news is just yeah. to see if there's people in your network mentioned so you could send them a note, just keeping in touch.
Yeah, but I also, like, for us, like for what we're doing here and for the listeners, and it's a great community of people. I vicariously appreciate when they come to you, and I, you know, we have a purpose here. We do. And that was what brought me here. But I think that, yeah, some of it's superstition. Some of it's like, hey, it's habit. Some of it, but I think a lot of it also, like, I like to read the actual papers. Like I remember Mayor Bloomberg had said, like, he liked to read the actual papers because you see stuff you're not looking for. And or it sparks different things. But sure, I would read different things. And
by the way, you've quoted like over 100 people now so far in this podcast. Like you, but again, you're borrowing the wisdom from Bloomberg. You're borrowing the wisdom from, you know, whoever. So I don't think it's a bad thing. It's just you have this memory for quotes. It's the three mutant powers, I will say. You have this memory for quotes. You have this enormous network. And I guess related to that power is the power to kind of keep up with that network so that everyone, I would say, ranges from thinking on the upper end, like He's Steve Cohen is great. I'm always going to return his call and do whatever he asks. And the worst is, okay, Stephen Cohen is this mildly weird guy, but I'm still going to return his call. Because I remember I told one guy who's been a frequent guest on this podcast, we just hired this producer. He's coming from TV, the Good Day New York. And he said, is it that weird guy, Steve Cohen? But then a few months later, came up to me and said, man, I can't believe you got Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on your podcast. How'd you get him? And I was like, Steve Cohen.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think my dad used to always say, like, with his patients, and I think 95% of them loved him, but most people hopefully swear by you. Some are going to swear at you. And again, that's fine, too. Like, with me, with people, like, I've seen all kinds of people, and weird's fine. I think if you're a nice person, I can deal with, you know, like if you're a genuinely nice person.
Yeah, the person who said that didn't mean anything bad.
That's fine too, you know, but like maybe I am probably a little bit weird and you know.
He certainly didn't mean it as an insult, but you are a little bit weird.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. No.
Because you speak in quotes and you know every single human being on the planet.
No, of course. And you know, no, and I definitely, it's funny, like speaking of quotes, like remember in Dumb and Dumber where there's that scene where he goes, what a complete moron. And then he goes, no offense. And then he says, none taken. So I'm not offended. It's fine. I think that I just try and be the best version of me I can be. And I try and treat people the way I want to be treated. But I also think there is a difference. I just think you want to be genuine. You know, you want to be like who you are. And I remember years ago, I read a book by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who had like the 5 stages of death and dying. Yeah. And it impacted me because she wrote like her autobiography and she said when she got older, you know, she was this celebrated speaker at universities. And she always knew if like the people, and up on stage, the president would walk her up and put his arm around her and give her this really like bombastic kind of introduction. And then like an hour later when everybody left, she'd be left to go get to her car. This like frail old lady trying to go to her car because nobody was watching and they weren't doing it that way. So, you know, they weren't as concerned about her once everybody left. They were concerned about what they were doing in public. You know, it's the old, like, be more concerned with your character than your reputation. Like, this is who you are. And so I think in general, I hope you people around me are the same day, like I always say, like those that know you best should love you most, like your friends and those around you. And those are the ones, hopefully, that we should care about, you know. But you treat people fairly. You treat people the way you'd want to be treated. And when I try not to be, like, I've had people approach me. I've been on both sides of it. And, like, they approach you checking in or, like, you know, and, like, or, like, it could be an intern who came back, like, you know, all the whole year they weren't really interested. And then come May, they're about to graduate. And then, hey, I loved working with you, and it's like a form letter, and it's not genuine, and I don't know. It's not the way it should be done, you know, as far as I think.
You know, and it's weird because on the one hand, like I've seen you approach a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like so the other thing you do is now I will list another mutant superpower, which is you somehow get invited to every single TV screening, book party, movie screening. We saw, I mean, Louis C.K.'s movie was never even released, and we saw the movie in a theater. It was just you, me, and a friend.
Yeah.
And no one else in the whole theater.
Yeah, it was fun.
And then the next day, the movie was never released.
Yeesh. Yeah.
And we saw, we've seen so many movies and TV shows and plus other screenings and symposiums and this and that. And every symposium we go to, you know, there might be a crowd of 500 people, but you are always know the main people on the stage, and I'm able to talk to them because you know them.
But I also feel like, look, you are the Honda Civic. You sell yourself. Like, it should be, I believe in what we're offering. I believe it. I could evangelize about it because I've seen you. I know what you could do.
Sometimes, so I always, 100% of the time, I see you go up to the people and say, we should have you on the show. We should do this. We should do that. And, you know, I loved you in this, loved you in that. You're always able to have a conversation. Some people respond very well to it. Some people back off a little bit. And so my question is, at first I thought maybe you're not reading all of their social cues, like an Asperger-ish kind of thing, which I think there's a little bit element of that.
100%. And, of course.
But I think also it's like you say, you're not really asking anything, and it doesn't really hurt to talk to them for 3 seconds. And so I think that's part of your approach too, so that they remember you later and later and later.
Yeah. Look, I think, again, getting back to Seth Godin, I was influenced when he said, when I got 3 rejections, I said, oh, great, only 96 more to go, you know? And I honestly believe they were offering something really good to people. What are we offering them? You know, a vast, educated listenership, some smart people, a great conversation with somebody who prepares. Like, I can go up to people. We had, one of our first interviews since I was here was Nancy Cartwright, who is the voice of Bart Simpson and a lot of other people. And afterwards, she was gushing. Like, this was the best interview I ever saw. Like, you prepare. And
well,
I was impressed with it.
Like with Nancy, I mean, I watched the movie. Her movie hadn't yet been released. I watched the whole movie, and I cited everything in her career. 29 years as Bart as Bart Simpson and all her acting career before then. And she was so fascinating to me. But you also, like, we're going to interview someone in a little bit. You also read the books. Like, I spent the whole night reading this book, and you also read the book.
I tried to read the book. I felt like, again, John Wooden, rest in peace. He always felt like if you don't have time to do it right the first time, when are you going to have time to do it over again? And I felt like, oh, that's a great opportunity. Like, maybe we could connect on this or, because you're not going to go back. You're not going to try and do it. And so I try to, I just do my best. And I think that's what I'm trying to do here. And for those listening and, you could tell us what you think and how you found me weird or tweet at James. But I want us to be the best. I want us to be the best. And so I think that, it's like the expression, like, champions do every day what losers do only occasionally. And there's a way to approach it. I want to say Mike Tyson or something, who also famously said, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face.
Yeah.
So I think that you should, or, you have to do things that you hate and act like you love them. But I enjoyed it. It's great. It's an honor to, like, meet these authors and these brilliant people.
But you met them at Good Day New York and see this early show. So my question is, like, how many, so while you were at Good Day New York, I don't know where it was when you started, but when you,
they were third, and it wasn't just because of me, but, like, then they became number one. They were,
While you were there, I mean, I think you bring in the guests and that brings in the viewers, it became number one in the biggest regional market in the country. So,
and there were other reasons.
And how many people view a morning show like that? Like, what are the numbers?
It's, 250,000 maybe, 300,000, in New York,
So every day?
Every day, yeah, which was fine. I mean, at the early show is 3 million and today's show is like 6 million, which I wasn't.
Why'd you go from the early show to Good Day New York?
I went from the early show. I had a friend, Dave Price, who was an anchor, who became an anchor at Good Day New York. And I'd left in 2012 when they switched over from the early show to CBS's Morning, when that Charlie Rose and Gail King and them came in. And I was actually getting a little bit tired of TV to begin with. There was other things I kind of wanted to do. But then Dave, and again, just for you listening out there, I remember he had gotten the anchor job over there. He'd been weatherman at the early show. And we were close. And he said, hey, I know you know those people, but if you want to come, love to have you work with me. So
you didn't mind going to a show that had 1/10 the audience?
I was reluctant to it. I mean, I felt like, I remember joking with Dave and I said, Dave, I feel like Olivia Newton-John and I'm in Australia with my lover and you want me to go back to Rydell High? And he was like, I feel like Olivia Newton-John too because I want to get physical with these people, And he had wanted somebody he knew and felt like
I feel like Olivia Newton-John because I want to go back to Xanadu.
Exactly. But I felt like, and I remember starting there and I remember it was different and I remember coming in and I remember feeling a little bit defeated that I was going back to television because I wanted to do other stuff. And when I got there, I remember reading The Psychology of Winning and Dennis Waitley had said, successful people focus on the flowers, not the weeds. And I said, wow, here's a chance. And believe me, when I went there, some of the other producers, they weren't hugging me, singing me kumbaya. They were like threatened, who is this guy? Or they probably had their own thoughts about, well, why is he going from network TV to local? And it was an environment that was fine,
And how do you deal with that kind of hostility in the workplace from your coworkers?
I remember, among other things, it's funny. I remember when I was at the early show, people knew me, and so I could wear more colorful shirts. And I remember honestly joking, like, I didn't want to, I just wanted to be like, come in a certain way. And I remember saying, the nail that sticks out gets hammered. I'm going to wear a white shirt. And I wore like a white, I look like a white shirt and like every single day. I wasn't wearing pastels. But I felt like, that's fine. You got to get along to go along. And I just, I knew like persistence beats resistance. I felt like, I had a job to do, and I didn't necessarily take it. I didn't take it personally. Like I didn't.
It seemed to me like you were just very focused on just every day getting the best possible guests, and ultimately that would prove
everybody
that you were.
Yeah, of course. And but you know, truth is, like it's.
Yeah, just, and you don't seem like the type to play office politics.
No, I wasn't like that. And the truth of the matter is, I was working really, really hard all the time, and I didn't have time to kind of politic over there and to shoot the breeze with management over there. And I would say this to everybody out there, you know, that I felt like you want to be around people who really want you to do well, and not just people who don't want you to screw up. And some environments are better than others. I felt like the experience wasn't going to have meaning unless I really excelled. You know, the narrative of your arc is to go from network to local. And I knew that, like a basketball coach or something who went from pros to college, like, okay, if you can win a national title there, it's going to have meaning and it's going to be exciting. And so jump to when I came with you throughout my career, like I brought network level people to a local radio station. Then I did it at network TV. And then when I went to local TV, I was able to bring network type people to, and I looked at it in sports, like you were almost like a mid-major. Again, you and I share a huge interest in sports. You know, you're reading those box scores every day.
Zero interest in my part, but you know every statistic from 1909 onwards.
Like, but and you get back about like your network too. Like I always felt like you want people to be, you want things to be a push towards you rather than a pull. You want to select. You don't want to just keep recruit. But I knew, like when I got there, you know, I knew I was going to bring really exciting people over there and an energy, and it was going to make it better for that place over there. And that,
because you were coming from a national platform to a local, so you had that network.
I had that network, but I was Avis. I tried harder. You know, I did. And like, I was, these people are paying me. It's a job. And like, you're going to go.
So now you even quoted like an advertising slogan. But okay, why'd you go from TV and being the number at the producing the number one morning news show in New York City to the podcast world?
I always had an interest in podcasts. I think like people over there would always make fun of me because when we would have a guest on, I think like podcasts kind of got bigger recently, but we'd have a guest on and I would try and walk to work every day, and you know, it was about a half hour walk, and like if we were going to have a guest on, I would always listen to them. You know, I would try and maximize my time. So I started discovering podcasts and I got really into them. And like people would joke saying, oh, you love podcasts? You like Rotten Tomatoes? Because I would always quote Rotten Tomatoes. And I remember one time we had a woman from Rotten Tomatoes and we had that actor Eric Andre. And I said,
love Eric Andre. Can we get Eric Andre in the podcast?
Yes, he'd be terrific. Hi, Eric. And he was very self-effacing and really bright guy. But I remember saying to the Rotten Tomatoes, I'm like, I'm not new to this. I'm true to this. Like, for example, Eric Andre, The Internship, 34% Rotten Tomatoes. And he was like...
The Internship, Man Seeking Woman, who, by the way, you know, I had Simon Rich on twice, wrote the book.
And have Jay Baruch that we'll have to have on.
And Eric Andre, The Eric Andre Show is the most brilliant...
And Hannibal Buress. So you guys are welcome if you're listening, as I know you are. So, Eric, please come. And we'll have a great
time. By the way, this is the kind of conversation Steve and I have about guests.
Yeah.
Is that like suddenly I'll get like fascinated by somebody and I'll like beg you, like, this is the only one I want on.
No, he's great. But that was one thing. Okay. So you asked me why I went to podcast. And I did feel like, so then you'd come in April and I kind of remember, you're a fascinating, brilliant guy. And I followed it away. And then a year later, we had Ryan Holiday for his book, Perennial Seller. And all of a sudden, like, you're like his wingman, his road dog. You're kind of hanging out with him there. And I'm like, holy moly, this is James. And it just seemed like the right... And Ryan and I were chatting about a lot of different things. And I want to say Lee Child was there.
No, Brad Thor.
Brad Thor, sorry. And, you know, and every... And we were chatting and I mentioned that I was really exploring, you know, trying something different and going into this arena because I really enjoyed it. And you said, well, I'm looking for somebody. And so I was really excited and interested. And then we started talking. And for those people out there, I felt like this guy is authentic. Like this guy is something else. Like I wanted, and just when we started talking about guests that you talked about who was there that day. And I remember, like, I kind of broke it down for you like a fine powder. I was like, okay, this person's there and his publicist is kind of a little bit abrasive. And then you said, well, I don't even want that person. I want this person. And you were so interested in every single thing. And it was the old line like you heard about people where they said they're interesting and interested. And you are. And that's what you want. Like I always felt like I'd rather tame a wild horse than motivate a mule. And you want to be at a place worthy of your talents. And you want somebody who is really, really wants to do well. Like you want to be the best. And it was different. And you know, having worked in TV for a long time, you would deal with a lot of people who are narcissists. And it was a way, and I joke about it, like the old Chris Rock line where he said when Siegfried and Roy were attacked, everybody was like, that tiger went crazy. He's like, that tiger didn't go crazy, that tiger went tiger. That's the nature of the beast. There's an insecurity, they're on TV. But they kind of, to me, a lot of these people, it seems like they want fame and they get addicted to it. And it's you may want all those things, you know, but it's like you really appreciated like that people, you really wanted to help people. You'd been through your own troubles and were honest and authentic about it. And I saw the way you treated other people, I watched around and I felt like, wow, you know, like Wayne Dyer said, I wanted to be like a no limit person, you know? Do you have one second? I just want to drink from this Kool-Aid.
Wayne Dyer, by the way, was like my second or third podcast.
And it was a great interview. But I did find that to be, and I did try and do my research and I looked around some mutual friends we had and I read the Forbes magazine piece, which said you're a great dad, or the other one said you're the most interesting person in the world, or I saw different things and I felt like, you know, but I felt like I remember saying to you again, you're a huge sports fan. We could be like Belichick and Brady and we have a great team here and they're great. It's, you know, our friends, the people at Agora who put or Jay and just, you know, Michelle and Pam and Savannah and, you know, Bill who does work with us. So they're great people and I'm excited, Matt and Doug, you know, so it's a great team and I'm excited and it, you know, to be part of it.
I would say that on the one hand, podcasts are great because we've stayed pretty consistent to the theme of peak performance.
Yes.
So that's why, like, someone might be famous for some newsworthy reason, but if they're not, like, the peak performer or the best in the world or something we're having at some point, we usually say no. You pitch a thousand ideas to me, and, you know, a lot of them are no's, and I feel bad sometimes saying no, but I'm able to explain the reasoning, and you're like, okay, fine. Like, right away, you say, okay, fine. The other thing is, I forgot what...
But you were talking about, like, moving from TV to podcast, why I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But I remember when we met, you were saying, Steve, I think this is, like, 1951 television, and we're in the first inning, and I felt like...
Well, and also we're able to get a lot deeper with the guests than a three-minute segment. Like, we have two-hour podcasts sometimes. Like, we're able to really dive in deep to someone's life and the parallel between their life and their work and their peak performance and what struggles they had. And it really teaches people how to achieve peak performance. I don't think you can get it. You can't really do that on a morning news show.
No, absolutely. And I remember you said, hey, and good morning, New York. And you didn't even have the name right of the show. And, you know, you're like, they asked me for 3-5 minutes, but here I could go in for a long time. And yeah, I think it's a great medium. I think that I feel like if we're going to do it, let's do it and be the best at it. Let's give our most value to it. And again,
but okay, let me ask you this. Yeah. Like, again, the numbers are still not as high as TV.
Yes.
So you went from national TV to local TV to here. And, you know, the numbers are getting up there with local TV and cable TV. But it's not there yet. Do you think it's going to...
I do think they're going to keep getting better and better. And I just... Because for us, I mean, I think you do an amazing job. You know, we're going to keep at it. And I think we're going to keep doing better with it. We'll get better. And more people are going to find value. I think it's just what you said. Like, it's we have to be disciplined, and we have to be like the bartenders that don't just serve what we want to drink, but what other people want to drink, that we think of them.
By the way, the fourth mutant superpower, you send out, I remember you told me in the beginning, send out 50 to 100 letters a day asking people to come on the podcast, and certainly 98% of them say no, and 2% might say yes, and so you deal with, you're asking a lot, and you're dealing with a lot of rejection, but you never really take it as a rejection. You always
sometimes I got better at it. Like, I got better at, you know, and I've learned a lot. Honestly, swear to God, like, you know, we talk about like having a quantum leap, but like, I learned a lot in this period of my life. But, you know, I think it's not about me. It's not about my ego. It's about, we're offering them something really good. And I think like, we try and be as honest as possible and figure out a way that it could be mutually beneficial to the guest who comes and feels like, wow, you know, James invested in them. He asked me good questions. He wasn't trying to be gossipy. He wasn't trying to make it transactional. He was trying to learn something, and he was genuinely curious. And what I could tell everybody who listens, like, when I would see you outside of this, this is who you are. Like, you meet friends of mine and you ask these questions and you're concerned about them, or people came up, we had an event here in New York, and these people were appreciative that you were genuinely curious. And I've seen a ton of people where they weren't concerned about, you know, people in the public eye. They weren't concerned about those people, and they didn't, you know, and people would travel to see them, and they weren't interested in them. So, but how do we get better? I think we have to do things every day that other people aren't doing. We have to provide more value.
It's hard. Like, I see you, like, you're constantly reading, because that's how you get news, and also you read the books of the guests and potential guests. So you're constantly reading, you're constantly writing to people, whether it's following up or asking them, or and also you have this way of connecting the dots. So you'll say, this person has this publicist, and we've had on this other publicist person as a guest. So now you're constantly connecting the dots, and that's how you generate your 50 emails a day. And then you follow up to all the rejections, and you ask again, and then at night, you're every 7 nights a week, you're at screenings or events or whatever, and you ask me to go to a lot of these, but I just can't. Like, how do you have a personal life?
No, I've fortunately been starting to have more of a personal life, and I think you have to allow yourself to do it. And I think, you know, I'm fortunate to have a lot of friends or dating, you know, I'm single. I hope to, you know,
meet the right
person. Maybe meet the right person, or maybe I've already met that person. And I think I don't necessarily. It's not like I'll go to the opening of an envelope. Like, I try and say no. I mean, I think, you know, and one of the things I've even said to us with what we were doing, I remember Graydon Carter famously said, it's not who you let in, it's who you let out, like, when you do stuff. So for us, we shouldn't always go for the low-hanging fruit or what's easy, and we have to have intent. Why are we putting this person on?
I mean, some of the guests you've got on, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wolfgang Puck, I've never seen these two on podcasts before. You've gotten a lot of people on who have been on zero other podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, no, thank you.
Richard Branson.
And that's something I think about a lot, not having about what he said. Like, James, I was very impressed with that interview, and it really impacted me, because you kept pushing him. You said, what if you're not a billionaire? What if you're not rich? What if you're not, like, outgoing? And he just said stuff that I think about every day, like, a lot, where it's like, people want to be around people who are positive. People want to be around people who praise you. People want to be around people who look for the best in other people. So I felt like I got a lot out of that. I hope our listeners do too. And so that's what animates me. Like, I'm not trying to be like a taxidermist to get all these pelts on the wall like some other people do. Like, we want to be the best. We want to have the best podcast. And that is what appealed to me about you. You really, really want on a mission, and we'll get there. And and I think we're doing an amazing show for those who are listening now. And what you realize too, it's like, and I realized this at Good Day New York, and I remember Gretchen Rubin, who I think is terrific, and she came one day.
She's been on twice.
Yeah, she's great, and I loved a lot what she had to say. But I remember she came, and we had, these rappers from the Lox, a guy named Styles P and Angela Yee, who came on about their juice bar, and hopefully we're going to do stuff with them. And I remember, among other things, she wrote a book called like Money, Power, Respect, and he had a rap song called Money, Power, Respect, because I remember they were talking to each other, and she had no idea who he was, but she felt like, okay, we live in an area of micro celebrity. Like, we live in an area where, and so that's fine. Like, you, for me, or you ask about numbers, it's you bloom where you're planted. Like, you're here, and like, and it's not quantity, it's quality of what you're doing. And you have said it, Ryan Holiday said it, like, we do a really good product, and a thing of beauty is a joy forever, and we're gonna really do a good job with it. But like, so I'm not really concerned about it. Like, now that I've moved away from TV or other medias, like, we try and ascribe value based on external factors. You know, it could be like, I could buy a sweater and they'll say, oh, you know, this sweater is a cashmere sweater for $300. And
like, the you one know, I'm wearing,
yeah. But like, you can get it for $50. Well, it might not be worth $300. You know, it might not be worth $50 for you. And similarly, okay, just because like a million other people watch something doesn't mean that it's better for me or for us. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there. And so hopefully, you know, the more people who are exposed to it are getting value from it, and we get better. And,
So you know, I think what I wanna point out is this podcast is gonna come out. I also think this is the one of the times where check out the post that goes along with this podcast, because I think what we should do is extract every quote at its source that you've said. We should title this podcast The Tao of Steve. Let's get all your quotes out there, plus your mutant superpowers and maybe like books on how to get those superpowers. Because I think they're somewhat learnable, even yeah. from people who are not quite on the Asperger spectrum. and you know, I also want to mention, Steve, we're not just doing the podcast; we're trying other things like YouTube channels, and you're working on projects. We'll talk about them next time. We'll definitely have you on as a guest again.
Let me check my schedule and see if I'm free.
Thanks so much,
Thank you, Steve Cohen, producer of the
James Altucher Show podcast. You've brought on so many amazing guests, and I think people need to learn from your example if they're doing anything basically in life.
Yeah, thank you. I've enjoyed working with you and everybody here. I think they're amazing people, so I'm excited. So looking forward to many more happy returns.
All right. That was good, Steve. What'd you think?
Yeah, that was great, right? Good stuff.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.